water splashing in your face. But it's not okay to hit when you're mad. You can use words and tell Daddy, "I don't like that. Please stop." Your discipline can now maintain your authority. That's crucial. But you can do so from a more informed and compassionate position. And your child is more likely to internalize a lesson because you're teaching it when his brain is more receptive to learning. As any veteran parent knows, flipping the lid isn't unique to toddlers. It may look different when it occurs in a 10-year-old, but a child of any age, or even an adult, is prone to having the downstairs brain take over in high emotion situations. That's why an awareness of the upstairs brain and the downstairs brain and the tantrums that originate from each place can help us be much more effective as we discipline our children. We can more clearly see when it's time to draw the line and when it's time to bring lots of nurturing compassion to help engage the upstairs brain. Tantrums provide just one example of how practical this upstairs, downstairs knowledge can be. Now, let's talk about other ways you can help develop your child's upstairs brain and allow it to become stronger and more integrated with the downstairs brain.
What you can do, helping develop and integrate your child's upstairs brain. Whole brain strategy number 3, engage, don't enrage, appealing to the upstairs brain. Ask yourself as you interact with your kids through the day, which part of their brain you're appealing to. Are you engaging the upstairs, or are you triggering the downstairs? The answer to this question can go a long way toward determining the outcome of one of those delicately balanced parenting moments. Here's a story about a time I faced just such a moment with my son. While eating out at one of our favorite Mexican restaurants, I noticed that my 4-year-old had left the table and was standing behind a pillar about 10 feet away. As much as I love him, and as adorable as he is most of the time, when I saw his angry, defiant face, coupled with his repeated tongue thrusting, aimed at our table, adorable was not the word that came to my mind. A few diners at surrounding tables noticed and looked at my husband Scott and me to see how we were going to handle the situation. In that moment, Scott and I felt the pressure and judgment of those watching and expecting us to lay down the law about manners at a restaurant. I clearly saw two choices as I walked over and crouched down eye level with my son. Option number 1, I could go the traditional command and demand route and open with a cliched threat uttered in a stern tone, "Stop making faces, young man. Go sit down and eat your lunch or you won't get any dessert." At times, option 1 might be an appropriate parental response. But for my little guy, this verbal and nonverbal confrontation would have triggered all kinds of reactive emotions in his downstairs brain, the part scientists call the reptilian brain, and he would have fought back like a reptile under attack. Or, option number 2, I could tap into his upstairs brain in an effort to get more of a thinking, as opposed to a fighting-reacting, response. Now, I make plenty of mistakes as I parent my boys, as they'll freely tell you. But just the day before, I had given a lecture to a group of parents about the upstairs and downstairs brain, and about using everyday challenges, the survival moments, as opportunities to help our kids thrive. So, luckily for my son, all of that was fresh in my mind. I decided to choose option number 2. I started with an observation. "You look like you feel angry. Is that right? Remember connect and redirect?" He scrunched up his face in ferocity, stuck out his tongue again, and loudly proclaimed, "Yes!" I was actually relieved that he stopped there. It wouldn't have been at all unlike him to add his latest favorite insult and call me Fartface Jones. I swear I don't know where they learn this stuff. I asked him what he felt angry about, and discovered that he was furious that Scott had told him he needed to eat at least half of his quesadilla before he could have dessert. I explained that I could see why that would be disappointing, and I said, "Well, Daddy's really good at negotiating. Decide what you think would be a fair amount to eat, and then go talk to him about it. Let me know if you need help coming up with your plan. I tousled his hair, returned to the table, and watched his once again adorable face show evidence of doing some hard thinking. His upstairs brain was definitely engaged. In fact, it was at war with his downstairs brain. So far, we had avoided a blow-up, but it still felt like a dangerous fuse might be burning within him. Within 15 seconds or so, my son returned and said to Scott in an angry tone of voice, "Dad, I don't want to eat half of my quesadilla, and I want dessert." Scott's response perfectly dovetailed with my own. "Well, what do you think would be a fair amount?" The answer came with slow, firm resolve. "I've got one word for you. 10 bites. What makes this unmathematical response even funnier is that 10 bites meant that he would eat well over half the quesadilla. So Scott accepted the counteroffer, my son happily gobbled down 10 bites, and then his dessert, and the whole family, as well as the restaurant's other patrons, got to enjoy lunch with no further incidents. My son's downstairs brain never fully took over, which, luckily for us, meant that his upstairs brain had won the day. Again, option number one would have been perfectly fine, even appropriate, but it also would have missed an opportunity. My son would have missed a chance to see that relationships are about connection, communication, and compromise. He would have missed a chance to feel empowered that he can make choices, affect his environment, and solve problems. In short, he would have missed an opportunity to exercise and develop his upstairs brain. And I hasten to point out that even though I chose option number two, Scott and I still had to address the misbehavior part of the incident. Once our son was more in control of himself and could actually be receptive to what we had to say, we discussed the importance of being respectful and using good manners in a restaurant, even when he's unhappy.
This is an example of how simple awareness of the downstairs and upstairs brain can have a direct and immediate impact on the way we parent and discipline our children. Notice that when the challenge arose, Tina asked herself, "Which part of the brain do I want to appeal to here?" She could have gotten what she wanted by challenging her son and demanding that he change his behavior immediately. She has enough authority in his eyes that he would have obeyed, albeit resentfully. But that approach would have triggered the downstairs brain, and his anger and feelings of unfairness would have raged within him. So instead, Tina engaged his upstairs brain by helping him think through the situation and find a way to negotiate with his father. Let's make one thing clear. Sometimes there is no place for negotiation in parent-child interactions. Children need to respect their parents' authority, and sometimes that means that no simply means no, without wiggle room. Also, sometimes counteroffers are unacceptable. If Tina's 4-year-old had suggested that he take only one bite of his lunch, his dad wouldn't have been open to striking that particular deal. But as we parent and discipline our kids, we are given so many opportunities to interact in ways that engage and develop their upstairs brain. Consider this scenario. A mother refuses to buy her daughter a necklace. Their conversation could go like this. "I hate you, Mommy." "That is not okay to say. I don't want you to ever say that again." This would enrage her child's downstairs brain. Or their conversation could go like this. "I hate you, Mommy." "Wow, you're really mad." "Yeah, I hate you." "Is it because I didn't get you that necklace?" "Yes, and you're so mean." That necklace wasn't for sale. It's okay if you want to keep feeling upset, but if you'd rather, we can be problem solvers and think of another idea. How do we do that? The mother chose not to present an ultimatum that would enrage the downstairs brain. Instead, she engaged the upstairs brain by first directing her daughter to use more precise and specific words for how she was feeling. "Are you feeling really mad because I didn't get you that necklace?" Then, she asked her daughter to work with her to be a problem solver. Once the girl asks, "How do we do that?" the mother knows that the upstairs brain is engaged. Her daughter is now able to discuss the issue with her mom in a way that she couldn't just a few seconds ago. Now they can brainstorm together about getting another necklace at the store or making one at home. The mother can also now talk to her daughter about how to use her words when she's angry. Every time we say, "convince me," or come up with a solution that works for both of us, we give our kids the chance to practice problem-solving and decision-making. We help them consider appropriate behaviors and consequences, and we help them think about what another person feels and wants, all because we found a way to engage the upstairs instead of enraging the downstairs.
Whole brain strategy number 4, use it or lose it, exercising the upstairs brain. In addition to appealing to our children's upstairs brain, we also want to help them exercise it. The upstairs brain is like a muscle. When it gets used, it develops, gets stronger, and performs better. And when it gets ignored, it doesn't develop optimally, losing some of its power and ability to function. That's what we mean by use it or lose it. We want to be intentional about developing the upstairs brain of our children. As we've been saying, a strong upstairs brain balances out the downstairs brain and is essential for social and emotional intelligence. It's the foundation of solid mental health. Our job is to provide our kids with opportunity after opportunity to exercise their upstairs brain so that it can grow stronger and more powerful. As you and your children go through your day, watch for ways you can focus on and exercise different functions of the upstairs brain. Let's look at a few of them one by one. Sound decision making. One big parental temptation is to make decisions for our kids so that they consistently do the right thing. But as often as possible, we need to give them practice at making decisions for themselves. Decision-making requires what's called executive functioning, which occurs when the upstairs brain weighs different options. Considering several competing alternatives, as well as the outcomes of those choices, gives a child's upstairs brain practice, strengthening it and allowing it to work better. For very young children, this can be as simple as asking, "Do you want to wear your blue shoes or your white shoes today?" Then, as kids get older, we can give them more responsibility in the decision-making and allow them to take on some dilemmas that can really challenge them. For instance, if your 10-year-old daughter has a scheduling conflict, both her Girl Scout campout and her soccer playoff are on Saturday, and she clearly can't be in both places at the same time, encourage her to make the choice. She's much more likely to be comfortable, if not completely happy, about having to give up one commitment if she's been a part of the process of making the decision. An allowance is another terrific way to give older kids practice at dealing with difficult dilemmas. The experience of deciding between buying a computer game now or continuing to save for that new bike is a powerful way to exercise the upstairs brain. The point is to let your children wrestle with the decision and live with the consequences. Whenever you can do so responsibly, avoid solving and resist rescuing, even when they make minor mistakes or not so great choices. After all, your goal here isn't perfection on every decision right now, but an optimally developed upstairs brain down the road. Controlling emotions and the body. Another important and difficult task for little ones is to remain in control of themselves. So we need to give them skills that help them make good decisions when they are upset. Use the techniques you're probably already familiar with. Teach them to take a deep breath or count to 10. Help them express their feelings. Let them stomp their feet or punch a pillow. You can also teach them what's happening in their brains when they feel themselves losing control, and how to avoid flipping their lid. We'll help you with this in the Whole Brain Kids section at the end of the chapter. Even small children have the capacity to stop and think instead of hurting someone with their words or their fists. They won't always make good decisions, but the more fully they practice alternatives other than lashing out, the stronger and more capable their upstairs brain will become. Self-understanding. One of the best ways to foster self-understanding in your children is to ask questions that help them look beyond the surface of what they understand. Why do you think you made that choice? What made you feel that way? Why do you think you didn't do well on your test? Was it because you were hurrying? Or is this just really difficult material? This is what one father did for his 10-year-old, Catherine, as he helped her pack for camp. He asked whether she expected to feel homesick while she was away. When he received the expected non-committal maybe in response, he followed up with another question. How do you think you'll handle that? Again, he received a non-answer. I don't know. But this time he could see her beginning to think about the question, if only a little. So he pressed further. If you do start feeling homesick, what's something you can do to feel better? Catherine continued stuffing clothes into her duffel bag, but she was obviously thinking about the question now. Finally, she offered an actual answer. I guess I could write you a letter, or I could do something fun with my friends. From here, she and her father were able to talk for a couple of minutes about her expectations and concerns about going away, and she developed a bit more self-understanding, simply because her father asked her a few questions. When your child is old enough to be able to write or even just draw, you might give him a journal and encourage daily writing or drawing. This ritual can enhance his ability to pay attention to and understand his internal landscape. Or, for a younger child, have her draw pictures that tell a story. The more your kids think about what's going on within themselves, the more they will develop the ability to understand and respond to what's going on in the worlds within and around them. Empathy. Empathy is another important function of the upstairs brain. When you ask simple questions that encourage the consideration of another's feelings, you are building your child's ability to feel empathy. At a restaurant, why do you think that baby is crying? While you're reading together, how do you think Melinda is feeling now that her friend moved away? Leaving the store, that woman wasn't very nice to us, was she? Do you think something might have happened to her that made her feel sad today? Simply by drawing your child's attention to other people's emotions during everyday encounters, you can open up whole new levels of compassion within them and exercise their upstairs brain. Scientists are beginning more and more to think that empathy has its roots in a complex system of what are being called mirror neurons, which we'll discuss in the next chapter. The more you give your child's upstairs brain practice at thinking of others, the more capable he will be of having compassion. Morality. All of the above attributes of a well-integrated upstairs brain culminate in one of our most important goals for our children, a strong sense of morality. When kids can make sound decisions while controlling themselves and working from empathy and self-understanding, they will develop a robust and active sense of morality, a sense of not only right and wrong, but also what is for the greater good beyond their own individual needs. Again, we can't expect absolute consistency because of their still developing brain, but we do want to raise questions regarding morals and ethics as often as possible in normal, everyday situations. Another way to exercise this part of the brain is to offer hypothetical situations, which kids often love. Would it be okay to run a red light if there was an emergency? If a bully was picking on someone at school and there were no adults around, what would you do? The point is to challenge your children to think about how they act and to consider the implications of their decisions. In doing so, you give your kids practice thinking through moral and ethical principles, which, with your guidance, will become the foundation for the way they make decisions for the rest of their lives. And of course, consider what you are modeling with your own behavior. As you teach them about honesty, generosity, kindness, and respect, make sure that they see you living a life that embodies those values as well. The examples you set, for good and for bad, will significantly impact the way your child's upstairs brain develops.
Whole brain strategy number 5. Move it or lose it. Moving the body to avoid losing the mind. Research has shown that bodily movement directly affects brain chemistry. So when one of our children has lost touch with his upstairs brain, a powerful way to help him regain balance is to have him move his body. Here's a story a mother told us about her 10-year-old son and a time he regained control by being physically active. 2 days after Liam started fifth grade, he felt completely overwhelmed by the amount of homework his teacher had assigned. I agreed with him, by the way. It was a lot. He was complaining about it, but he eventually went to his room to work on it. When I went to check on his progress, I found him literally curled up in a fetal position under his beanbag chair in his room. I encouraged him to come out, to sit at his desk and keep working on his studies. He kept whining, saying he couldn't do it. It's just too much. I kept offering to help him, and he kept refusing my help. Then, all of a sudden, he jumped out from under the beanbag chair, ran downstairs, ran out the front door, and kept running. He ran several blocks through the neighborhood before coming home. When we had him safely back in the house, and he had calmed down and had a snack, I was able to talk with him and ask why he had taken off like that. He said he didn't really know. He said, "The only thing I can think of is that I felt like it would make me feel better if I ran as fast as I could for as long as I could, and it did." And I have to admit, he did seem a lot more calm and ready to have me help him with his homework. Even though Liam didn't know it, when he left the house and ran, he was practicing integration. His downstairs brain had bullied his upstairs brain into submission, leaving him feeling overwhelmed and helpless. He had floated way over near the chaos bank of the river. His mother's attempts to help bring in his upstairs brain were unsuccessful, but when Liam brought his body into the conversation, something changed in his brain. After a few minutes of exercise, he was able to calm his amygdala and give control back to his upstairs brain. Studies support Liam and his spontaneous strategy. Research shows that when we change our physical state through movement or relaxation, for example, we can change our emotional state. Try smiling for a minute. It can make you feel happier. Quick, shallow breaths accompany anxiety. And if you take a slow, deep breath, you'll likely feel calmer. You can try these little exercises with your child to teach her how her body affects how she feels. The body is full of information that it sends to the brain. In fact, a lot of the emotion we feel actually begins in the body. Our churning stomach and tense shoulders send physical messages of anxiety to the brain before we even consciously realize that we're nervous. The flow of energy and information from the body up into our brainstem, into our limbic region, and then up into the cortex changes our bodily states, our emotional states, and our thoughts. What happened for Liam then was that the movement of his body helped bring his whole self into a state of integration, so his upstairs brain, his downstairs brain, and his body could all, once again, do their jobs in a way that was effective and healthy. When he felt overwhelmed, the flow of energy and information became blocked, resulting in disintegration. vigorously moving his body, released some of his angry energy and tension, allowing him to relax. So after his run, his body sent calmer information to his upstairs brain, meaning that his emotional balance returned, and the different parts of his brain and body began to function again in an integrated way. The next time your children need help calming down or regaining control, look for ways to get them moving. For young kids, experiment with what might be called creative, loving trickery. For example, while getting dressed, your toddler says, "I want to be naked." Instead of replying in a command and demand style like, "I've already told you it's time to get dressed, put your clothes on now or you'll get a timeout." Try "move it or lose it." "I want to be naked." "Well, let's play a dressing game. Do a jumping jack and then we'll put your pants on." The fun of this game, coupled with the physical activity, can completely change your toddler's mindset and make the whole morning much more enjoyable for both of you. This technique works for older kids also. A Little League coach we know heard about the move it or lose it principle and ended up having his players jump up and down in the dugout when they got discouraged after giving up a few early runs during the championship. The boys' movement brought a shift of excitement and new energy into their bodies and brains, and they eventually came back and won the game. Chalk up another victory for neuroscience. At times, too, you can simply explain the concept. "I know you're mad you didn't get to go on the sleepover with your sister. Doesn't seem fair, does it? Let's go ride our bikes and talk about it." Sometimes just moving your body can help your brain feel like things are going to be okay. However you do it, the point is to help your child regain some sort of balance and control by moving their body, which can remove blockages and pave the way for integration to return.
Whole brain kids. Teach your kids about their downstairs and upstairs brain. Kids can pretty easily understand the upstairs-downstairs information we've presented in this chapter. Here's something you can tell your child to help get the conversation going. Your downstairs brain and your upstairs brain. Make a fist with your hand. This is what we call a hand model of your brain. Remember how you have a left side and a right side to your brain? Well, you also have an upstairs and a downstairs part of your brain. The upstairs brain is where you make good decisions and do the right thing, even when you are feeling really upset. Now lift your fingers a little bit. See where your thumb is? That's part of your downstairs brain, and it's where your really big feelings come from. It lets you care about other people and feel love. It also lets you feel upset, like when you're mad or frustrated. There's nothing wrong with feeling upset. That's normal, especially when your upstairs brain helps you calm down. For example, close your fingers again. See how the upstairs thinking part of your brain is touching your thumb so it can help your downstairs brain express your feelings calmly? Sometimes when we get really upset, we can flip our lid. Raise your fingers. See how your upstairs brain is no longer touching your downstairs brain? That means it can't help it stay calm. This is what happened to Jeffrey when his sister destroyed his Lego tower. He flipped his lid and wanted to scream at her. But Jeffrey's parents had taught him about flipping his lid and how his upstairs brain could hug his downstairs brain and help him calm down. He was still angry, but instead of shouting at his sister, he was able to tell her he was angry and ask his parents to take her out of his room. So the next time you feel yourself starting to flip your lid, make a brain model with your hand. Remember, it's a brain model, not an angry fist. Put your fingers straight up and then slowly lower them so that they're hugging your thumb. This will be your reminder to use your upstairs brain to help you calm those big feelings from the downstairs brain.
Integrating ourselves. Using our own mental staircase. My young son was screaming for 45 minutes and I didn't know how to comfort him. I finally screamed back, "Sometimes I hate you." My son was 2 and scratched his baby brother's face so hard that he left marks. I spanked his bottom like 5 hard swats. Then I left the room, walked down the hall, turned back around, and spanked him probably 5 more swats again. I screamed at him so loud I terrified him. After I had told my daughter to watch out for her little brother running in front of the swing, she almost swung right into him. I was so mad that even in front of other people at the park, I said to her, "What's wrong with you? Are you stupid?" These are some pretty awful parenting experiences, aren't they? They represent our downstairs moments, the times when we're so out of control that we say or do something we'd never let anyone else say or do to our child. The confessions I've just read come from real parents whom we know personally. And although it may surprise you, each of those parents does a great job at raising their kids. But like the rest of us, they just lose it from time to time and say and do things they wish they hadn't. Could you add your own downstairs moment to the list I just read? Of course you could. You're a parent and you're human. We see it time and again when we speak to and counsel parents. In high-stress parenting situations, parents make mistakes. All of us do. But don't forget, parenting crises are openings for growth and integration. You can use the moments when you feel yourself losing control as opportunities to model self-regulation. Little eyes are watching to see how you calm yourself down. Your actions set an example of how to make a good choice in a high emotion moment when you're in danger of flipping your lid. So what do you do when you recognize that your downstairs brain has taken over and you've begun to lose your mind? First, do no harm. Close your mouth to avoid saying something you regret. Put your hands behind your back to avoid any kind of rough physical contact. When you're in a downstairs moment, protect your child at all costs. Second, remove yourself from the situation and collect yourself. There's nothing wrong with taking a breather, especially when it means protecting your child. You can tell her you need a break to calm down so she doesn't feel rejected. Then, although it might feel a bit silly at times, try out the move it or lose it technique. Do jumping jacks, try some yoga stretches, take slow, deep breaths. Do whatever it takes to regain some of the control you lost when your amygdala hijacked your upstairs brain. You'll not only move into a more integrated state yourself, but also model for your kids some quick self-regulation tricks they can use. Finally, repair. Quickly. Reconnect with your child as soon as you are calm and feeling more in control of yourself. Then, deal with whatever emotional and relational harm has been done. This may involve your expressing forgiveness, but it may also require that you apologize and accept responsibility for your own actions. This step needs to occur as quickly as possible. The sooner you repair the connection between yourself and your child, the sooner you can both regain your emotional balance and get back to enjoying your relationship together.
Chapter 4. Kill the Butterflies. Integrating memory for growth and healing. There's no way I'm taking swimming lessons this summer. My 7-year-old made this firm proclamation when he found out we had signed him up for lessons at our local high school pool. Sitting at the dinner table, he glared at us, setting his jaw and narrowing his eyes. I looked to my husband, Scott, who shrugged as if to say, "Okay, I'll go first." "I don't get it. You love swimming." "Exactly, Dad. That's the point." He even sounded sarcastic. "I already know how to swim." Scott nodded. "We know you do. The lessons are to help you get better." I added. Plus, Henry's doing it. You'll be hanging out with him every day next week. He shook his head. No way. I don't care. He looked down at his plate, and a hint of fear crept into his determined voice. Please don't make me do this. Scott and I exchanged a look and said we'd think about it and continued the discussion later. But we were shocked. It was absolutely unheard of for our son to turn down any activity with Henry, his best friend, especially one related to athletics. Situations like this come up all the time for parents, where they are left completely baffled by the way their child responds to something they say. When fear, anger, frustration, and other big emotions overpower children, and they act in ways that don't make sense, there may be an easily fixable reason. They may simply be hungry or tired, or maybe they've been in the car too long, or maybe it's just because they're 2, or 3, or 4, or 5, or 15. But other times, a child acts out or behaves uncharacteristically because of more deep-seated reasons. For example, as Scott and I spoke later that night, we agreed that our son's surprising right-brained response likely resulted from a mildly traumatic experience he had undergone 3 years earlier, an experience he probably wasn't even thinking about. I knew this was a great time to introduce my son to a couple of important facts about the brain. So at bedtime that night, that's what I did. Before I tell you about that conversation, I should first explain what I was trying to accomplish when I talked to my son. I knew that one of the best ways to help a child deal with difficult experiences is to understand some basics about the science of how memory works in the brain. Memory and the brain. A couple of myths. Let's start with two myths about memory. Myth number one. Memory is a mental file cabinet. When you think back about your first date or the birth of your child, you just open the appropriate file drawer in your brain and call up that memory. It would be nice and convenient if this were true, but that's just not the way the brain works. There aren't thousands of little memory files in your head waiting for you to access them and bring them to consciousness so you can think about them. Instead, memory is all about associations. As an association machine, the brain processes something in the present moment. An idea, a feeling, a smell, an image, and links that experience with similar experiences from the past. These past experiences strongly influence how we understand what we see or feel. That influence occurs because of associations in the brain, where different neurons, or brain cells, become linked to each other. So in essence, memory is the way an event from the past influences us in the present. Imagine, for example, that you found an old pacifier between your couch cushions. What kind of emotions and memories would you experience? If you still have a baby in the house, maybe nothing too earth-shattering. But if it's been a few years since your little one used a pacifier, then you might be flooded with sentimental associations. You might remember how giant it looked in your newborn's mouth, or how quickly you moved the first time your toddler shared the binky with the dog. Or you might relive that wretched night when you all said goodbye to pacifiers for good. In the moment that you find the pacifier, all kinds of associations rush back into your awareness, impacting your present feelings and mood based on strong associations from the past. This is what memory essentially is, association. Without getting too complicated, here's what goes on in the brain. Anytime we undergo an experience, neurons fire or become activated with electrical signals. When these brain cells fire, they become linked with or join other neurons. These linkages create associations. As we explained in the introduction, this means that every experience literally changes the physical makeup of the brain, since neurons are constantly being connected and separated based on our experiences. Neuroscientists explain this process with the phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. In other words, every new experience causes certain neurons to fire, and when they do, they wire together or link up with other neurons that are firing at the same time. Doesn't this fit with your experience? The very mention of biting into a lemon can make you salivate. Or a song in the car transports you back to an awkward slow dance in high school. Or remember when you gave your 4-year-old a piece of bubblegum after ballet class that one time? And what did she want and expect after every ballet class from then on? Of course, bubblegum. Why? Because her end of ballet class neurons had fired and wired with her bubblegum neurons. Neurons that fire together, wire together. That's how memory works. One experience, the end of ballet class, causes certain neurons to fire. And those neurons can get wired to neurons from another experience, getting bubblegum. Then each time we undergo the first experience, our brain connects it with the second one. Thus, when ballet ends, our brain triggers an expectation of getting gum. The trigger might be an internal event, a thought or a feeling, or an external event that the brain associates with something from your past. Regardless, this triggered memory then sets up expectations for the future. The brain continually prepares itself for the future based on what happened before. Memories shape our current perceptions by causing us to anticipate what will happen next. Our past absolutely shapes our present and future. And it does so via associations within the brain. Myth number 2. Memory is like a photocopy machine. When you call up memories, you see accurate, exact reproductions of what took place in the past. You remember yourself on your first date with ridiculous hair and clothes, and you laugh at your own nervousness. Or you see the doctor holding up your newborn, and you relive the intense emotions of that moment. Again, that's not quite how it happens. Well, the ridiculous hair and clothes may have really happened, but memory is not an exact reproduction of events from your past. Whenever you retrieve a memory, you alter it. What you recall may be close to exactly what happened, but the very act of recalling an experience changes it, sometimes in significant ways. To put it scientifically, memory retrieval activates a neural cluster similar to, but not identical with, the one created at the time of encoding. Thus, memories are distorted, sometimes slightly, sometimes greatly, even though you believe you are being accurate. You've had those conversations with your sibling or your spouse where after you tell a story about something, they say, "That's not how it happened." Your state of mind when you encoded the memory and the state of mind you're in when you recall it influence and change the memory itself. So the story you actually tell is less history and more historical fiction. Keep these two myths in mind as we talk in the following pages about your kids and the way their past experiences impact them. Remember that memory is all about linkages in the brain, as opposed to being alphabetical files to be accessed whenever needed, and that retrieved memories are by definition vulnerable to distortion, as opposed to being detail for detail accurate photocopies from your past. The truth about memory. Let's get explicit and implicit. Think about your memory for changing a diaper. When you approach a changing table, you don't actively talk yourself through the process. Okay, first place the baby on the pad. Now unzip the pajamas and remove the soggy diaper. Place the clean diaper under the baby and... No, none of that's necessary because when you change a diaper, you just do it. You've done it so many times before, you don't even think about what you are doing. Your brain fires off clusters of neurons that let you undo the tabs, remove the diaper, reach for a baby wipe, and so on, all without ever even realizing that you are remembering how to do it. That's one kind of memory. Past experiences, changing diaper after diaper, influence your behavior in the present, changing this particular diaper, without any realization that your memory has even been triggered. If, on the other hand, you think about that day you first changed a diaper, you might pause for a moment, scan your memory, and come up with an image of yourself nervously gripping a baby's ankle, then cringing at the mess you find in the diaper, then struggling to figure out what to do next. When you actively think about these images and emotions, then you're aware that you are recalling something from the past. This is also memory, but it's different from the memory that enables you to change a diaper now without thinking about it. These two types of memory interweave and work together in your normal everyday living. The memory that enables you to change your baby without knowing that you are remembering is called implicit memory. Your ability to recall learning to change a diaper or to recall any other specific moment is explicit memory. Usually, when we talk about memory, we mean what is technically explicit memory, a conscious recollection of a past experience. But we need to know about both kinds of memory for our own sake as well as for that of our children. By getting a clear handle on these two different types of memory, we can provide our kids with what they need as they grow and mature and deal with difficult experiences. Let's start by focusing on implicit memories, which begin forming even before we are born. Dan tells a story about an informal research study he performed in his own family.
When my wife was pregnant with each of our two children, I used to sing to them in the womb. It was an old Russian song that my grandmother had sung to me, a child song about her love for life and for her mother. May there always be sunshine, may there always be good times, may there always be mama, and may there always be me. I sang it in Russian and in English during the last trimester of pregnancy, when I knew the auditory system was wired up enough to register sound coming through the amniotic fluid. Then, in the first week after each child was born, I invited a colleague over for a research study. I know it wasn't a controlled study, but it was fun. Without revealing the prenatal song, I sang three different songs in turn. No doubt about it, when the babies heard the familiar song, their eyes opened wider and they became more alert, so that my colleague could easily identify the change in their attention level. A perceptual memory had been encoded. Now my kids won't let me sing. I probably sounded better underwater. My newborn children recognized my voice and the Russian song because that information had been encoded in their brain as implicit memories. We encode implicit memory throughout our lives, and in the first 18 months, we encode only implicitly. An infant encodes the smells and tastes and sounds of home and parents, the sensations in her belly when she's hungry, the bliss of warm milk, the way her mother's body stiffens in response to a certain relative's arrival. Implicit memory encodes our perceptions, our emotions, our bodily sensations, and, as we get older, behaviors like learning to crawl and walk and ride a bike, and eventually change a diaper. What's crucial to understand about implicit memory, especially when it comes to our kids and their fears and frustrations, is that implicit memories cause us to form expectations about the way the world works, based on our previous experiences. Remember the connection between ballet and bubblegum? Because neurons that fire together wire together, we create certain mental models based on what's gone on in the past. If you hug your toddler every evening when you come home from work, he'll have a model in his mind that your return will be filled with affection and connection. This is because implicit memory creates something called priming, in which the brain readies itself to respond in a certain way. When you get home, your son anticipates a hug. Not only is his internal world primed for receiving that loving gesture, he'll even move his arms in anticipation when he hears your car in the driveway. As he gets older, priming will continue to operate with more complex behaviors. A few years later, if a piano teacher frequently criticizes his playing, he may create a mental model that he doesn't like piano, or even that he's not musical. A more extreme version of this process occurs in the case of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, where an implicit memory of a disturbing experience becomes encoded in a person's brain, and a sound or image triggers that memory without the person even realizing it's a memory. Implicit memory is essentially an evolutionary process that keeps us safe and out of danger. It frees us to be able to react quickly or even automate our responses in moments of danger without having to actively or intentionally recall previous similar experiences. What all this means for us as parents is that when our kids seem to be reacting in unusually unreasonable ways, we need to consider whether an implicit memory has created a mental model that we need to help them explore. This is what Tina did for her son when she tucked him into bed and talked with him about the swimming lessons. Their conversation went something like this.
Can you tell me anything about what's going on with the swimming? I don't know, Mom. I just don't want to do it. Are you afraid of something? I guess. I've just got all of these butterflies in my stomach. So let's talk about those butterflies. Did you know that your brain remembers things even when you don't know you're remembering? I don't get it. Okay, let me say it a different way. Do you remember you had a bad experience with swim lessons before? Oh, yeah. Do you remember that place we went? They were so hard on us there. Those were some pretty strict teachers. They made me go off the diving board, and they dunked my head and made me hold my breath for a long time. It was a long time, wasn't it? And you know what? I think that has a lot to do with why you don't want to go to swim lessons now. You do? Yeah. Do you know that lots of times when you do things, whether they are good or bad, your brain and body remember them? So when I say Dodger Stadium, you're smiling. Do you feel what's going on inside you now? What are your brain and body saying? How do you feel? Excited? Yes, I can see that on your face. And do you feel butterflies in your stomach? No way. And what about when I say swimming lessons? Does that change how you feel? Uh-huh. And the butterflies are back? Right. I don't want to go. But here's what I think is going on. Your brain is amazing, and one of its important jobs is to keep you safe. See, your brain is always checking things out and saying, this is good or this is bad. So when I say Dodger Stadium, your brain says, good, let's go. That's a fun place. But when I say swimming lessons, your brain says, bad idea. Don't go. Exactly. And the reason your brain gets so excited when I say Dodger Stadium is because you've had good experiences there. You probably don't remember every detail of every game, but still, you just have a good overall feeling about it.
You can see how Tina introduced this issue, just setting up the concept that certain memories can affect us without our awareness that something is coming from the past. You can also probably see why her son was nervous about swimming lessons. And one of the biggest problems was that he had no idea why he was nervous. He knew only that he didn't want to go. But when Tina explained where his feelings were coming from, he began to develop some awareness that let him take control over what was happening in his brain. so he could begin to reframe his experiences and his feelings. They talked some more, then Tina introduced him to some practical tools he could use when he started feeling nervous about swimming lessons. Some of the very tools we'll discuss with you soon. Here's how the end of the conversation went.
Okay, so now you know that the reason for your fear is that you had bad experiences before. Yeah, I guess. But you're older and wiser now, and you can think about swimming in whole new ways. So let's do a couple of things to help you feel better. One is to start thinking about all the memories you have of swimming that have been really fun and good. Can you think of a good swimming experience? Sure, when I was swimming with Henry last week. Right, good. And you can also talk to your brain. Huh? Seriously. In fact, this is one of the best things you can do. You can say, Brain, thanks for trying to keep me safe and protect me. But I don't need to be afraid of swimming anymore. These are new lessons with a new teacher, a new pool, and I'm a new kid who already knows how to swim. So, Brain, I'm just going to blow out the butterflies from my stomach with some big, slow breaths like this. And I'm going to focus on the good stuff about swimming. Does that seem weird to talk to your brain like that? Kind of. I know, it's funny and kind of strange. But do you see how it could work? What's something you could tell your brain to make your body calm down and make you feel safer and feel good about going to swimming lessons? What could you say in your mind? Those bad swimming lessons were just in the past. Now this is a new swim lesson, and I already like swimming. Exactly. Because how do you feel about swimming in general? Great. Great. And now let's do one more thing. What's something you could do or say to your brain if you start feeling nervous again when we first get to swimming lessons? Like a code to help remind yourself that these feelings are from the past. I don't know. Kill the butterflies? Because the butterflies are from a long time ago and you don't need them in your stomach anymore, right? Right. I love it. And I'm glad you're laughing about it now, but could we come up with a less violent code? How about liberate the butterflies or free the butterflies? I kind of like kill. Okay, kill the butterflies it is.
Notice that the main thing Tina did here was to tell the story of where her son's fears came from. She used narrative to help his implicit memories become explicit and full of meaning, so they wouldn't act on him with such hidden power. Once his implicit memories about the unpleasant swimming lessons were brought into the light of awareness, he could more easily deal with his present-day fears. It's in this transformation from implicit to explicit that the real power of integrating memory brings insight, understanding, and even healing. Integrating implicit and explicit, assembling the puzzle pieces of the mind. Implicit memories are often positive and work in our favor, like when we fully expect to be loved by those around us simply because we've always been loved. If we count on our parents to comfort us when we're hurting, since they've always done so before, that's because a host of positive implicit memories have been stored up within us. But implicit memories can be negative as well, like when we've repeatedly had the opposite experience of our parents being irritated by or uninterested in our times of distress. The problem with an implicit memory, especially of a painful or negative experience, is that when we aren't aware of it, it becomes a buried landmine that can limit us in significant and sometimes debilitating ways. The brain remembers many events, whether we're aware of them or not. So when we have difficult experiences, anything from a twisted ankle to the death of someone we love, these painful moments get embedded in the brain and begin to affect us. Even though we're not aware of their origins in the past, implicit memories can still create fear, avoidance, sadness, and other painful emotions and bodily sensations. That helps explain why children, as well as adults, often react strongly to situations without being aware of why they are so upset. Unless kids can make sense of their painful memories, they may experience sleep disturbance.